So interesting kind of readings to begin this new year. King David is having family problems. So Absalom is one of his sons, and Absalom has now attempted to stage a coup and to overthrow the rule of King David. And it seems that most of the people have now come alongside of Absalom rather than David, which strikes us as very odd, because it seems that David was the best of all of the kings of Israel, of the 42 kings that reigned in the United Kingdom and in the divided kingdom. David was surely the best, and you know, the greatest of them. Perhaps Solomon would kind of come up there alongside of him. So that Absalom is staging this overthrow, it seems odd. But what is even stranger is the attitude of David. First, when he realizes that Absalom is beginning to raise an army, he flees. He's still got his army, he's still got his supporters, and there are many that would stand alongside of David. But he goes from Jerusalem because he doesn't want to have a bloodbath there in the city. So we begin to see something of the character of David. And so we're told that he has his head covered, he's barefoot, and he goes up to the Mount of Olives, weeping as he goes, and all of his followers do likewise. And you know, when you are in Jerusalem, you know that going anywhere barefoot is a dangerous kind of business, because it's such rocky, uneven ground. And so he's there on the Mount of Olives, looking back over the city, as he still can today. And it's there that this strange character of Shimei, a follower of the previous king of Saul, who David had overthrown by receiving the favor of the Lord. And he begins to curse, you know, in this very fierce and terrible way, David, to the very core of who he was. A cursing that, you know, is inappropriate and is also unfair for who David is. I mean, yes, he's made mistakes and he's sinned, but he certainly doesn't deserve this terrible cursing. And later on, we'll read that Shimei actually comes back to David to apologize for offering this profound curse against him. But it's the character of David in this that is significant. He could have easily ordered one of his soldiers, and then one of his soldiers came and said, you know, let's chop off his head. Let's, you know, stop this man from cursing you right now. But David accepts it as the will of God, as the fate of God, which again is such a powerful thing to do. This, you know, very unjustified cursing and all of these criticisms and insults that are being thrown at him. And David accepts it. David just receives all of this. And it's a profound thing in any kind of literature, but especially in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Old Testament. There's very few examples of anyone who does this. And it becomes a shining light of this whole sense. You know, when people criticize us, perhaps occasionally teachers might get criticized by students and other staff members. But this profound sense of David just accepting it and receiving it and then allowing it to be formative for him. The signs of evil and the presence of evil are also in our gospel today. It's one of Mark's great stories, one of his truly great stories. He forms it in a very dramatic form. At the end of chapter 4, he's been there on the boat, and this storm has just erupted, and the sea is this turbulent mix of waves and wind, and he's asleep on a cushion in the back of the boat, and the disciples are afraid, even though they're seasoned fishermen, even though they're well used to storms on the sea, on the lake. But they're afraid that the whole boat is going down, and they can't believe that Jesus is sleeping through the midst of all of this. And Jesus, when he awakes, commands the waves and the sea, and they quieten down. He brings peace and quiet to the situation. And then immediately we're told that he goes to the other side of the lake. So he's come from Capernaum, from Capernaum, up in the northwest part of the lake, and traveled the whole length of the lake, because it's more longer north-south than it is east-west, and goes down to the southeastern corner to this region of the Gerasenes. Now, Gerar or Gadara, depending on the translation, isn't actually by the coast. It's about 25 k's inland. but its influences, it's part of what we call the Decapolis, this region of the 10 cities that were pagan, that were Greek-speaking, Roman-occupied areas. And since year 6 BC, the 6th Legion has also occupied that territory. So it's Roman-occupied and fiercely contested, but there's lots of a beautiful Hellenistic kind of culture, and it's a place of great thriving in comparison to the very backwater area of Galilee from which Jesus is coming. And so as he arrives in this pagan territory, who confronts him but this very emblematic symbol of paganism, this demon-possessed man who's so lost his humanity that he's in the midst of all of these symbols of death and destruction. He's there chained, and the chains aren't able to hold him. He lies down at night, and he lives among the dead. So he's there in the midst of a cemetery. You know, cemeteries were always fearful places, not just in Halloween movies, but this whole call of this man's loss of humanity. And he howls at night, so he's not even able to speak in normal ways. He grabs stones and gnashes himself. And at the end of the reading, we're told that he's now clothed. So the presumption is that he's unclothed at this point in his history. And the Gospel of Matthew and his version of it tells us that he's naked at this point. So this whole sense of the loss of dignity and humanity that this man represents, that he's just like an animal now. All of that sense of who he was meant to be, who he's been created to be, all of that has been lost. And again, it's you know, that sign of the meeting of and the clashing of these two very disparate cultures of Jesus representing Judaism and all the best of the call to holiness and all that he experiences in that, and then going into this utterly unclean environment, into the midst of this person who's lost everything that was ever good and ever hopeful, and the whole sense of this man being so possessed and so transformed by that encounter with evil that he's lost everything that has ever made him good. And yet he comes and he throws himself, we're told, at the feet of Jesus. We don't know whether it's really an act of worship or whether it's an act of submission. As we saw in the gospel yesterday, particularly if you were here at Mass, we saw this sense of the encounter between Jesus and the demonic forces and the demonic powers. And there is this attraction, you know, even though perhaps they don't even know, but they always, whenever these demonic powers come into the presence of Jesus, they lose. They're defeated because pure evil can never be in the presence of pure goodness, which is what happens when evil comes into the presence of Jesus. But he throws himself down and begins to shout again with the same cry that we heard yesterday from Mark 1 in verses 23 to 26. And here in chapter 5, it's the same declarations of, have you come to destroy us? This whole sense of recognition that Jesus is the Holy One. And Jesus is the Holy One of God. And Jesus is just there quietly ordering this man, this demon, into submission. Be quiet, get out of the man. All of the usual forms that we saw yesterday. And then this is this strange turn that Jesus will now ask the man, or ask the demons, what is your name? It's unusual in that it's not present in any of the other accounts that we have. And the man will say that he's Legion. And of course, in the midst of a place that's occupied by the Roman forces, perhaps it is that direct kind of sense of the very worst of everything that Rome represented. You know, the Pax Romani, the peace that was brought about by destruction, but brought about by that brutal enslavement of the local communities. But this man is able to make this declaration that he is possessed by this legion. A Roman legion contained between 2,000 and 6,000, 4,000, sorry, soldiers present within it, depending on the exact configuration. So it's kind of interesting that if it was the 2,000 number and there are 2,000 pigs that happened to be nearby, that local legion had its symbol, the boar. So it's all of these symbols are kind of being tied together when Jesus simply gives leave to the demons. He doesn't command that the demons go, but he just gives leave for them to do what they will. And so they choose this herd of pigs which in the Jewish mentality are nothing. You know, they're worthless. They're just a source of everything that is bad and evil and destructive. And so for that to be destroyed, again, is this call of God's goodness, wanting to bring order out of chaos. As this year begins, it is this reminder of the healing presence of God. When we find all of those senses and presences of evil in our own lives or in the lives of systems that are there and surrounding us, or occasionally perhaps you might suspect the presence of evil in one of your students or more, but this call for Jesus and to bring his healing, to bring that new life, to restore and to allow this man to find his victory and to find his life. It's strange that the man offers himself to Jesus to say, "Can I be one of your followers too? Can I join you? Can I be one of your disciples?" But Jesus will say, "No. I want you just to go back to your home, back to the place where you come from. I want you to minister there, in the ordinary, in the midst of your ordinary situations, that is where you will find your vocation and your life." It's not just people who, you know, join religious life or join the priesthood that are fulfilling their vocation, that some will indeed be called to bear witness to the truth and to this transformation that happens when we encounter Jesus in ordinary lives, like this man is called to do. This call of vocation, this call of sharing your gift and your life is what teachers are invited into, this experience of vocation, of sharing the life and love of God in the ordinary circumstances of a classroom, transformed and changed into the most extraordinary place of encounter, where students can discover the love of God and discover the love of learning that perhaps is not present in their home, and this incredible transformation that can happen when teachers embark upon this transformative experience of encountering God in their own lives and then sharing that with the students who are given to your care. So I really pray for you, pray in thanksgiving for the witness of your life, but I pray also that you will continue to allow the presence of Jesus to transform you, to heal you, to restore you, and to allow you, like David, to have that courage to accept criticism and to bear with that, but to allow the presence of Jesus to bring light and healing into every situation that you face.